Hey everyone, on this week's episode of 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, I'm joined by longtime professional goaltender Jeff Glass. He has an incredible story. In 2017, Jeff won his NHL debut with the Chicago Blackhawks, 13 years after being drafted by the Ottawa Senators. Before it happened, he spent time in the ECHL, AHL, and 7 years in Russia before coming back to North America for another shot at the show. Enjoy. All right, well, Jeff Glass, welcome to the podcast on 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. I'm really happy to have you because we're just a couple of relics that have been around, been all over the place. I'm sure we got tons in common, but we've never talked to each other really beyond a brief meeting at Center Ice. And I think really maybe even in Binghamton years and years ago when we were first right out of major junior for you and college for me. So let's start at the beginning of this. How'd you end up becoming a goalie? You're from Calgary in the first place, right? Were you from a big hockey family? What made you end up in the net?
Yeah, well, first off, thanks for having me on. Like you said, it's so weird actually finally getting to talk to you because everybody assumes we've had similar career paths that we should know everything about each other. But for whatever reason, we've never really connected. So, no, I appreciate you having me on. Hockey, right from the beginning. Well, grew up in Calgary, so you know how that goes, right? Canadian kid. Hockey's religion here for us. So I grew up with a couple younger brothers, but didn't come from, my dad never played professionally or anything like that. So I was raised just kind of like your standard Canadian kid where went to the rink every day and learned how to play, tried to play all the positions. And it didn't take me long to realize that I wanted to be a goalie.
So what sold you on the position? Because sometimes when you have younger brothers, that's the odd one. It's usually not that case. It's usually that the younger brother ends up being the goalie because the older brother said, hey, kid, get in there. So what drew you to the position?
Yeah, I think for me it was I enjoyed being on the ice. And I know that's a little bit cliche, but it was always I loved being on the ice and I hated coming off and changing. I hated the whole, you know, playing all the positions, skating up and down the ice. When I was in net, I could A, catch my breath, and B, I got to be out there the whole time. So that was the initial draw, I think. And then once we started getting into equipment and all the perks that came with being a goalie, I really realized that, hey, this is pretty cool. And it really took on a life of its own. And it was a young age. I was going to say I was 6 or 7 years old where they wanted you to start playing all the positions. And then they wanted you to start deciding, hey, if you're going to be a goalie, like, you got to be the goalie now, and we're not going to let you rotate around. And I think I was about 7 years old when I decided, yep, no, I want to be just the goalie, and that's what it was.
Were there any goalies from your era that you looked up to and kind of idolized, guys with the Flames or anybody else throughout the National Hockey League?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was very lucky to play in Calgary and grow up in Calgary, and Trevor Kidd had a goalie school here, and I'll never forget it. He was an idol growing up, so I got to go to his goalie school every summer. And with that being said, his backup at the time was Rick Tabarachi, and I'll never forget him either. And we had, you know, Curtis Joseph just up the highway too in Edmonton. So between those guys, those were kind of my idols growing up, and I always looked up to them. And it was really cool having those kind of figures that close to home.
So when I was 13, we went to Calgary with my Pee Wee Quebec team, and we played in the Crow Child tournament up there.
Nice.
And I don't know whether that was a big deal or not, but to us coming from St. Louis, it felt like it. We're going to Canada a second time. It was like this tack-on tournament at the end that was really cool. But we got to tour Calgary's locker room. And I remember walking in there, and I'm like head-to-toe blue sweatpants and everything. And there's Trevor Kidd's stall, though. And he's got about 10 different gloves and blockers, but it had all that, like all the Flames on it, you know, like he had like just sick equipment. And that's the first thing I remembered was how like unique his style was. I mean, did that influence you as a kid, like thinking I got to get gear like him too?
100%. And when he showed up to camp, I remember thinking, wow, like this guy's a big guy. He looks like an athlete. He looked like a superstar, like just a celebrity in every sense of the word. But the first thing I wanted to get to was his gear. I was curious if he brought his pads with him, and he did. And he let us all try them on and play with him. And there was nothing cooler. There really wasn't. And watching, I think at the time, and I don't want to throw him under the bus, but those things must have been like 40 inches tall. And you know, they came up right to my chin because they were so big. But it was so cool because they were just these big, bright colored pads. And I was like, I want to wear those. I need a set of those just like those. And yeah, that was definitely a huge influence on some of my gear and some of the reason why I wanted to play goalie moving forward.
I think he was really one of the first guys that took custom design to the next level, though. You know, think about before him. Like, it was pretty generic what guys would have. You'd have the front of the pad with just the blocky design, but like, he took it way off the chart by going with that flame, man. To me, that was just the coolest thing.
You look back at it now, and like, even guys in today are still trying to get custom graphics on their pads, and like, that was a long time ago, and he had it dialed right in at then. So it really was way ahead of his time, and credit to Brian's, credit to him, credit to anybody that was involved in that, because it was cool, and I think that changed the way a lot of goalies looked at goalie equipment and the position.
Imagine when that order form came across to the guys at Brian's. Like, you want us to do what with this? But I bet they were pretty excited about it. I mean, it was unique, but it took you, you're pretty young getting into junior hockey. What was the route to get there? Were you always super good at your position? Was it a process getting to that level? How'd you end up getting a major junior?
Yeah, it's actually a fun story that I don't get to tell very often, but I wasn't very good at all, and I never ever played on the top teams, and anybody that grew up playing with me knew I was always on the three or the four team, and there was at least two or three goalies that were better than me growing up, and it wasn't until probably midget hockey that I got to play on a double-A team, and finally got to make the double-A team, and I was so excited about it, and sure enough, I think we went like 2-28 that year, and I didn't have either of the wins, and it was one of the best things that could have happened for me as a goalie. I got pummeled every single night, but I got shots, and I got to play, and I had some soul-searching moments, and even at a young age, it's like, do you want to do this? Do you really want to be that guy that's, the goat in the net, and is this something you want to do? And I really did. And I knew that there could be a light at the end of the tunnel if I stuck with it. And sure enough, I did. So rather than going back the next year and playing midget AAA, I actually moved on to tier two junior, and I played junior A in Crow's Nest Pass. And it was a great opportunity. It was a coach that kind of took a flyer on me. And there was three of us 16-year-olds that were trying to figure life out as a 16-year-old moving away from home for the first time. But it was a perfect experience for us because we got to move away from home. It wasn't quite major junior where the eyes are on you, but it was junior hockey. And, there was a few 20-year-old guys kicking around the room. There was 20-year-olds in the league that were trying to score on you and move on in their career. So it really was a perfect stepping stone for me before I went to Kootenay and ended up playing in the Western Hockey League.
Did you feel like that was the hardest step of your career? I mean, for me, I felt going from Bantams to junior hockey was by far the biggest thing I'd done. And that was just tier two in the States. But I went from playing with like my high school team and Bantam guys at like 14, 15 to playing with 20-year-old Matt. But did you find that similar?
You know what? For me, it was a little different. I was kind of naive at that age, I feel like. I didn't really realize till I graduated to major junior how old these guys really were. I mean, off the ice, they all did their own thing. I wasn't allowed anywhere near them. But on the ice, I felt like, wow, hey, they're all shooting the puck the same. Once I got to major junior, you could really see the upper echelon players, how much better they were than the rest of us and how much you had to work to if you wanted to get to that level. For me, at least, the stepping stone was major junior to pro. And that was the first time I really experienced, oh, wow, like these guys are better than me. And these guys shoot harder. And this is to put food on the table. So a little different than you. My stepping stone for sure was junior to pro and just how much the game changed for me. And that was going to the East Coast. I wasn't playing the American League. It was major junior to East Coast, which should be an easy transition. For me, that was probably the hardest one.
I had the same thing. I went from college to the coast. I'm actually glad I spent 2 years there, though, because I felt like it got me ready when I got to the American League to grab that and run with it. So you were describing your time, though, with the Kootenay Ice. And we had a couple guys in common there. I've played with Adam Cracknell, I think, on six different teams, it feels like, at this point. Brett Sutter and I have done PHPA exec board together. First, what are your memories of those guys? And two, what was Kootenay like for you?
Yeah, well, that's funny. I get to throw Cracks under the bus now because I got to play with him this year. In Toronto and in San Diego. And it was the first time we've connected really since junior. So like 14 years later, he's changed a bit, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he lets me know if I need to know where I want to go sign. He's played on every team in hockey. So I just ask him first and he hooks me up with some details, but good guys. And same with Sutsy. It's great. He was in division this year with Ontario and we were in San Diego. So I got to chirp him a little bit, and it's fun to see how guys have changed. Like, we were all just kids, and Cracks, Suts, anybody in junior, it's your kids, and you look back 14 years later, holy cow, were we naive back then? We thought we had the world, and I was drafted in the third round to Ottawa, so man, was that a big deal. Like, I felt like I was I was right on track, and Crax was a seventh round. He might even been an eighth or ninth rounder. It was,
yeah,
I don't know how many rounds.
He was real late.
He was real late. This guy will never turn out. 14 years later, he's running the power play for our team in San Diego, right? So it's funny how that all changes and works. But two real good guys that have carved out awesome careers, and super happy for both of them.
Man, Crax is so funny to think about because he showed up in Vegas with the Wranglers. He went through the whole Calgary training camp, the Omaha Exurban Knights camp, and he ends up in Vegas, and he shows up with his Escalade, 20 years old, and like, he had a good junior career. Like, towards the end of it, scored a lot of goals, and I'm sure he was thinking that he was going to end up at least in Omaha, you know, and so it was a bit of an eye-opener for him. And I remember that just that first year, and he had a really bad injury too, like broke his leg in Idaho one night, and it was a grind for him. And then 4 or 5 years later, I'm talking with my friends in Peoria, and he's the captain of the team. I was like, holy shit, like, it's Captain Cracknell. Like, what happened, you know? And we ended up being teammates again after that. And it was just, you know, you talk about the maturity of how guys, how they change in a hurry sometimes. And pro hockey can do that to you, right? Like, you really find out what you're made of and what it's going to take to get to the next level.
Yeah, awesome point. Like, I got a soft spot for Cracks now just because we played together all year. It's a perfect example of a guy carving out a career for himself. He wasn't supposed to be a guy, and he decided he wanted to play pro hockey, not just play pro hockey, but make a real good living doing it. And he's done an unbelievable job of finding his niche of being that guy that gets dealt around every year. And I mean, it's you can laugh about it or you can make fun of him, but I don't even think it's that. It's honorable. He's willing to do whatever it takes to play pro hockey. And for him, it's meant moving around a little bit. But I mean, awesome, like, awesome career that he's had, and he's still kicking.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're in demand when you're like that too. People want you. But what struck me about him is really just how his game evolved, him being a crasher and being willing to do whatever he needed to instead of just a pure sniper. And like, I love Crax, man. Like, we've shared some really good moments along the way. And like, I think he saw me snap a driver on a T-box once, among other things. And just, you know, he's married, he's got kids. Like, it's so fun to see guys evolve, man. And like you say, 14 years later, because I can't imagine, like, I know what I was like in junior and the world was against me. And I look back, I just shake my head. I'm like, I can't believe I was like that. You know, like, how much you can grow as a teammate sometimes too.
It's a great example of perseverance, that guy, that's for sure.
So during your junior time, you were also part of the infamous 2005 World Championships, right? Basically the dream team for Canada. You were the backbone in the net. And you talked about your juniors in Tier 2 where you saw probably 100 shots a night where you didn't win, or midgets, I guess, right? Where you didn't win games. You had the polar opposite when you went to World Juniors, right? Probably 15 shots a night. I mean, how do you still perform when you're not seeing a lot of action like that, especially with that good a team in front of you with all the hopes of Canada on your shoulders?
Well, I always like to start my World Junior stories with, you know, I'm going to be the butt of every trivia joke come 5-10 years down the road here is, you know, name the starting goalie for the best World Junior team ever. And guys will go through Fleury and Price, and they'll go down every one. And I'm sure I'm a few down before they get to Jeff Glass, but it was an unreal experience. It was so much fun being there. And like you said, the hardest part about the team was probably trying to make it or then stay afloat in practice because guys had just bombs and everybody was so good. But, you know, unbelievable memories from that experience. I didn't ever think, let's go back to even Bantam when I'm 2-28 and grinding it out that, hey, a couple years down the road, you'll be the starting goalie for the World Junior team. But I kind of got on a heater. I started out really strong my second year. My third year, coming off the draft. I got drafted and I was feeling good about myself.
Yeah, you had
a good
juice
summer.
Behind you at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. You have the confidence going and all of a sudden.
Feeling the flow, doing the bowl dance, all that. Yeah.
Yeah. You get to camp and you're the big dog now because you've been drafted and, you know, you don't have to do the rookie skates. And all of a sudden I'm feeling good about myself. And I didn't get invited to any of the summer stuff with Hockey Canada. They had, I'm not sure if it was 4 or 6 other goalies that were penciled in to be the guys to come for the winter camp. And I wasn't one of them. And I just came out of the gates hot. And talking about Suts there, Brent Sutter took a flyer on me at camp. And we played, Kootenay played Red Deer quite a bit then. And I think that was a big thing. They were our rivals and I owned that rivalry. I loved it. It was a great time. And so I played well. He took me to camp. I had a great camp, made the team, right out of the team. It was me and Rajan Beauchemin, who I still keep in real good touch with. And Sutsi told me that I'd be the guy and that I was going to play. And like you said, once he got in the net, that was easy. You know, I think I had 20-something shots, low 20 shots in the gold medal game, and that was the most shots I faced in any game in the whole tournament. So it was a matter of just staying focused. You were going to get one or two quality chances a game, and as long as you you didn't do anything silly, we had a gold medal the whole way.
Just for the fun of it, let's see how many names you can rattle off from that roster. Go.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's see. Let's start it forward here. So I'm going to go, I think it was like, Bergeron, Crosby, Perry, Getzlaff, Ladd. I'm missing somebody on that second line. Then I think it was like Richards, Carter, Dawes, Stewart. You're putting me on the spot now. MacArthur, Dixon.
You're doing good.
And, yeah, I guess almost four lines. I'm
Steven
missing a
Dixon?
Few guys. I'm
Was
sorry.
That Steven
guys,
Dixon?
I'm sorry. Yeah, whoever I'm missing, I don't. Okay, let's go defense here. So it's Phaneuf, Weber, Seabrook, Cam Barker, Sean Bell, Danny Civret. Oh, I'm missing somebody else.
Danny Civret, there's a relic there. He wore a lot of jerseys too. You know, his brother's an NHL referee now.
Yeah, you know what? He reffed us in the American League this year a couple games, and he came up to me, and I looked at him like we kind of had that thing. We looked at each other, and he introduced himself. I said, "No way, how's your brother doing?" We had a good moment there, and sure enough, dropped the puck a couple seconds later. But it was awesome. Good, good guy.
That's funny, man. Like, that team had to be unbelievable to be on the ice for in practice, just the total skill level, like just through the roof.
That's my favorite story was right when we made the right when they announced the team, we went up north, northern Manitoba, because the tournament was in Grand Forks. We had our training camp in Winnipeg. So we took the bus and we drove up north to some city, and we got out there, and it was before the media could get to the rink. And that was my favorite, because guys were trying stuff that I could tell they didn't want to try when the cameras were on. You know, they'd get accused of maybe showboating or maybe being a little, and they were just, it was a full on pond hockey skill fest out there. And once the camera showed up, it was more, you know, the practices we're used to. But it was pretty cool to watch a couple guys kind of get out of their element and try a few things. And man, it was fun to be around.
Were there any personalities in that room that, looking back 14 years from now, you're kind of surprised how things played out for them, whether they changed or whether they became bigger than you expected or something like that?
I think there was a lot. Like, you've been in a ton of rooms just like me. You know how it is.
Yeah, a couple.
It takes a few personalities to make a locker room. And, you know, we had louder guys in that room. We had quiet leaders. We had all types. But people ask me who the best player was. And, with Crosby is the obvious answer. But he was 16 at the time. And, you know, it was Patrice Bergeron was coming down from – he played the years prior to that in the NHL, and there was a lockout year. So he went to Providence and played a year in Providence and joined us from there. And he's a year and a half into pro hockey, and we're all playing major juniors. And he was like our quiet leader. And I think he actually did win MVP of the tournament. He was hands down our best player. And so you talk about personalities, everybody, he's gone on to be surefire Hall of Famer, Stanley Cup champion, on and on and on. He was our leader. And then you had everybody else kind of fell into place after that. And, you know, it was guys like Corey Perry. I think even, you know, to start the tournament, wasn't really slotted in on a line, and he finds a home on the first line. And it was everybody kind of finding a home, and personalities kind of fit in. And you know, Brent Sutter, he didn't let any egos get out of check. So it was one of those teams where everybody knew that they were good. There wasn't any questioning skill level. It was going to be a matter of if we all slot in properly that. It was almost guaranteed we could win the gold medal.
So you win the gold medal. You're a national hero, basically, because it's everything in the world to Canada. And Ottawa sends you to the coast.
Exactly.
I want to hear how this happened, man, because to me, you would have been a surefire candidate to at least be in the American League. You're riding some momentum, and you end up in Charlotte, which, by the way, was in Charlotte, right?
It was, yeah.
I mean, good place to end up if you had to, but did you expect to end up in the coast, or was that a total shock to you?
completely caught me off guard. And it was a time when you can vouch for this. Like, it's very common. In fact, I would encourage most goalies to play at almost every level and realize, you know, how hard it is to play pro hockey and, you know, work your way up. There's a lot to be said for that. But when me and you were going through it, it was rare. There was, the East Coast was more of a, it wasn't a development league like it is now. It was more of a league where, hey, you know, you can't quite make it. You go there and maybe we'll call you up if someone gets hurt. And like, there was no plan. Yeah,
exactly. That was me. That was like, when I got there, I'm like, my goal is to make the American League. That's what exactly. I was thinking, because I wasn't even on an NHL deal. I wasn't like you, but yeah, so it was different back then.
It was. And so you want to talk about another summer coming in hot. So I get to Ottawa's camp now, probably with the same attitude, if not double, and you know, Canadian market. So, hey, the kid might make it out of camp for the Ottawa Senators. I'm thinking, oh, right, reading all these articles about myself, how good I am and how sweet I'm. Okay, hold on, Jeff, right? Like, not only you're not going to play in Ottawa, we're going to send you to Binghamton. And it was at the time, Billy Thompson, I think, and it was Kelly Gard,
yeah.
And they were light years ahead of me looking back. Like, I was so green and fresh. And I, yeah, athletic ability maybe, but like, there's a lot to be said about pro hockey and how to stop pro hockey puck. So I had a lot to learn. So I went from the NHL to an American League camp so fast to the East Coast, it made my head spin. I was in Charlotte and I remember thinking to myself, what did I do to deserve this? And it was not no fault to my own. And it was the best thing for me was going there. But at the time I wasn't ready for it at all. And so it was time to really start from the bottom and start chipping away at it.
Were you able to enjoy the experience though? Because some guys get there and you can tell they're just sour about it. They don't want to be there and they don't embrace it. Were you able to go the other direction and make good on it?
Yeah, you nailed it. It was like, Charlotte, what a spot. So you get there. We had an unreal group of guys. I still keep in touch with a few of them. And it was like, hey, Jeff, you're living in Charlotte. The weather's great. We went to a couple Carolina Panthers games right off the bat. You're playing pro hockey. We had the brand new rink right downtown there in Charlotte. Everything was great. Like, what do you have to complain about? So, like, take it as that view. And it really started to actually kind of carve out my – I don't want to say personality, but my perspective on life and hockey started right there, where it's like, here, you have two choices right now. You can either complain about living in Charlotte or you can, you know, enjoy this and go have some fun with it. And I chose the latter. I decided, hey, let's see what can happen here. And there was a few games in the coast where I was thinking, what the hell is going on right now? Like,
Bit of a circus sometimes.
Absolutely. We're looking for call-ups. And, you know, I think I had two or three defensemen that were healthy one game. So we had three guys called up from, I want to say, men's league. I don't even know if we had a league close enough where we could get guys from. So these guys were like, listen, don't play us much. Just we can like eat a few minutes. And we, one of my favorite stories was a couple of the defensemen took penalties. So we were down 5-on-3 and the coach sent out one of the beer leaguers to like kill it off for me. And it was one of my favorite penalty kills because he was diving head first. This was in the NHL for him. And he was like, I'm like, oh no, stay right in front of me. And he was diving around, blocking shots, ended up killing it off. And I mean, like that, it was fun. Like, what a story, right?
I'm sure you got that guy a couple beers after the game.
We definitely went for the beers after the game. And it was good stories all around. Yeah.
Well, that year did give you the chance, though, to get to Binghamton the following season. So it was a good enough year that you won games, you played well, and you get to Bingo for another 3 years after that. And you talk about some personalities, though. I mean, you played with Yablonsky and Karkner and, I mean, Denny Amell was there, I think, on a 3-year American League contract, which had never happened before, or something like that, right? So what are your memories from Binghamton once you got there? And you also had Tom Severance. We got to mention him. Great, incredible equipment guy. I love Sevy, but he was there with you. So tell me about your time in Bingo.
Yeah, Bingo was really like it shaped who I am as a hockey player. I learned a lot in Binghamton. So I got called up for a couple of games that year in Charlotte, and I got a taste of it. And like you said, you walk into Bingo's room, and I'm glad you brought up Sevy, because first guy you're going to meet is Tom Severance. And I'm like, all right, heard all about this guy.
Quite a presence. Yeah.
Yeah, quite a presence. What a beauty. He's like, all right, Glasser, what do you need? And at the time, I was a Coho guy. There you go. I'm dating myself. And I was a Coho guy, and he's like, yeah, all right, no. Well, you know, Todd Brown here has got Bauer gear. Maybe you're interested in that. And Sevy was the first guy who really opened my eyes on the fact that, like, in junior, it was like you got option A and maybe option B. But, like, why do you really need option B? If you're fine, like, you're fine. It's hockey equipment. And I was cool with that. Now it's pro hockey. It's like, well, this guy uses Vaughn and this guy uses Bauer. And Sevy was great. He's whatever you need, I'll help you out. And so now all of a sudden the kid in me is like, well, I mean,
let's try it all. We're at the equipment buffet.
And I think year two, I had a home and away set of pads. I had a red set and a white set because Sevy gave me the green light, which looking back for like a 20, you're right, a 21 year old kid, not what you need to be doing for him, right? But anyways,
we used to get like one set of pads and a set of gloves for junior for an entire season. Yeah.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden, I'm telling Sevy to only pack the red set on the road, right? Like real eye opener. But anyways, yeah, Sevy was the man. So I walked in to that room. My first full year was me and Kelly Gard. We actually roomed together as well, and it wasn't a good year on the ice as far as wins and losses. But we, it's pro hockey. You can't always be on a winning team, and there's enough movement in the American League where you start to realize real quick that a piece of humble pie is good for everyone. So I think I had something like a 4-something goals against average, and you'd get 40 shots a night, and it was just how life was in Binghamton. We weren't very good, but
you're grinding, man.
You grind, and that was it. It was year two of an entry-level deal, so keep grinding, and that was it. So year two, I played with some Denny Hamel, a couple guys like that just awesome guys. But, yeah, personalities to say the least. And then I want to say it was year two there, year three pro, a couple of the heavy hitters showed up, and that was like Yabo and the Karks and the Danny Bois. You tell stories to some of the guys now in the dressing room, and it's just such a different game. Like there was no veteran rule. So, you could have unlimited amount, and these guys weren't just tough. They were like real tough. And as a goalie who's trying to stop the puck in a smaller rink, for anyone who's been to Binghamton, it's not exactly a lot of space to mess around out there. So
it's the only rink I think in the league that's short. Cause Syracuse used to be 5 feet short and they lengthened it because Tampa Bay said, we're not going to affiliate with you if you don't make it regulation size. And I think I think Binghamton's the only one left. It's like 5 feet short. So that neutral zone is just tiny.
That makes sense. I wish I would have known that. That makes a lot of sense. Cause yeah, I knew it was a small rink, but I didn't actually know that it was the last one standing. So yeah, it was tight in there, and you'd have, we had the Yablonski Morastis. Morasti was in Syracuse, and so I think we saw him like 12 times a year, and these guys would just give it to each other, like twice a game, times 12. And oh my gosh, like just to be around that was insane. And me and Yabo had some good last week cross paths in Russia after that. So like we'd go back and tell some good bingo stories with each other. I think one of his favorite, I think we ended up winning a game in Binghamton. And we came into the locker room, and there was a water jug, like a water dispenser, and it was in like 500 pieces. And I remember thinking, like, we won the game. Like, what happened? And it was something to do with, like, Yabo got in a scrap. I don't know if it was a fan or if it was the ref or the coach or somebody along the way. And we came in after a 4-3 loss, and there was just plastic and water everywhere. And, like, in true Yabo fashion, he apologized and got a new one, like, the next day. But it was, like, he wasn't happy, and he let the water cooler get it.
So I want to talk about Binghamton itself, though, for a little bit, because I think it gets a bad rap that it doesn't really deserve. And I'll tell you why. It's because when teams from the visiting clubs drive in, you kind of go through that area by the river that doesn't look great. Kind of looks bombed out, to be honest, But yep. The year that I spent playing there in 11-12, we ended up having a lot of fun. It's not that expensive to live there. There's several bars and restaurants downtown that I thought was a great time. Like, we ended up having a lot more fun there than people give it credit for, I think. I mean, did you have the same experience?
Yeah. No, I talked to a guy. So we had a really close team, and you have to be in those small towns. And I think you hit the nail right on the head on how visiting teams get an impression of a city based on a visiting locker room, a visiting hotel or entrance. And that's how you just form an opinion on a town. Now, I lived there for 3 years, so I got a pretty good perspective of Bingo. But a guy like Colin Green came in right behind me, and they won. They won the championship that year. So that totally changed his impression on the whole thing. And he's like, yeah, we live downtown. It was a great city. Now, I lost for a couple of years there. So all my memories were like losing memories. And nothing against the town, but it's so funny how if you're playing in a town and you're winning, or you're playing a lot or whatever, you form a really good impression of that place. And, you know, I played in a few spots all around the world that maybe weren't the prettiest, but as soon as the hockey goes good, then all of a sudden you come home with a smile on your face. And now everybody at home's happy. And all of a sudden your opinion of that town totally changes. So not that I have bad impressions of Binghamton, but we just couldn't win there. So it was always a grind. And that's when I look back on Bingo, I don't look at super like, I hate that place. It was just, what a grind. Like, I couldn't seem to get my head above water the whole time I was there. And that will be my impression of the place.
That's a tough feeling, because I've had that too, where you're just absolutely fighting to stay alive, it feels like, every game. And I'll be honest with you, I had that with Ottawa this year, where we were going out and Craig and I, Anderson, were seeing legit 35-40. I mean, he had one night in Dallas where I think he saw 53, and that was the record for the Dallas franchise since they'd moved it from Minnesota, you know? So we're like, we're seeing a lot of rubber, and you're just trying to keep it like under three goals so you have a chance, you know? And that's really hard as a goalie, because you're used to that mindset of two or less and we're going to win this thing. Well, that's normal if you're seeing 30 shots a night, you know? It's really difficult to play into that role where you're just getting pelted.
I totally agree. And I it's so funny when your mentality changes like that. And you try to keep telling yourself, well, today was a three. We lost 5-3. You know, today was a four spot, but it was a good four spot. And eventually it drags you down. And I think the key to pro hockey, or anybody that's been successful, I know you know this story, is just finding a way to be positive through those grinds, because it happens to everybody in the career, and it sinks some guys. I think some guys, honestly, you know, they a couple four spots and that's the show. Good night. So I wish I could tell you that I had all these great stories from Binghamton, but when I look back, it was one of those cities where I was like, it taught me a lot, and it was a grind. It wasn't a bad experience. It was just a learning experience from start to finish.
So afterwards, you go to Russia, and we're going to touch on that. I want to just rewind really quick, because it was a kind of a good segue to it, though, how you're talking about your gear with Seve. And I always like to talk shop with this on the podcast, because there's so many goalie geeks out there, and I know I was too, and I still am like hardcore about it. What did you look for in your gear? Did you have any specs that were different, unique, or just what were you looking for? What did you like in your stuff?
Yeah, no, I actually love talking gear too, and I'm probably a closet gear nerd. I always prided myself on trying to be low maintenance, which is not something to be proud of, because I'm high maintenance. But I would try to tell everybody I'm low maintenance, and that, you know, I really just stock this and stock that. And for the most part, that part actually is true. I used to wear Coho pads, which transitioned to CCM, or you know, that whole phase. And that was always me. And so when I started in Coho, and my first couple of years were Pro, and like I said, I switched over to Bauer for a couple of years. And the Bauer pads, I tried to keep them as stock as possible. But there was a phase in my career, and we're going into Russia here, is I hooked up with a guy, Chris PQ, out of Detroit. I started doing Eli Wilson's goalie camps for him there. And I did them for 12 or 13 years in a row there. It was quite a few years. And Peaks helped me. He was the first guy that introduced me to modifying gear and how you could actually change the way you wear your gear. Because I, up until that point, and this is like 4 years into pro hockey, it came out of the box, I put it on, and that was that. And it really never changed anything. And I went from that to like almost the polar opposite of like, not one piece of my gear wasn't modified. If it was from like knee stacks, I used to land on this like super thin knee stack. And so I went to a crazy high knee stack, and I changed all my strapping setup around, and I had a super narrow leg channel, and it went super wide for a while. And moral of the story being, I completely did a 180 on my gear, probably about year five or six of pro, one of my first couple years in Russia. And I've come back full circle now. So now after Russia, I came back and I'm back in my CCM gear. And I actually tell the CCM, I tell Jerry every time, like, just as basic as you can keep it. I want the newest technology. I want you to tell me what the newest technology is, because I'm not super aware of why I'm wearing this, but you're right, that feels way better on me than the set you sent me before. So that's kind of my evolution of goalie equipment. I really do think that the way these companies make the pads now, you can almost custom a pad any way you want right on the customizer. If you're into whatever, if you're into a tight old school pad, go for it. If you're into state-of-the-art, no straps, light as it can be, you can have that as well. So I think goalie equipment's come a long ways, and now almost anybody can have it exactly the way they want it.
I'm kind of in the same boat that I always wanted the newest technology I could get. And I would tell them that I'll try it. You send me anything, I'll try it. And then we'll modify from there. But I think that it's almost gotten to the point where it's so optimized that my stuff really doesn't have a lot of custom element to it. Like, there's a couple of little things, maybe a strap here and there. But when it comes to the actual build of it, it's pretty close to stock. And that surprises people considering how much you can do. But what do you think of the guys, though, that are really stuck in the past that aren't willing to update with technology? Does it, as a guy like who's kind of like me that wants the new stuff, does it kind of irk you and bother you a little bit to see somebody just too stubborn to change?
Oh, it drives me nuts. And like, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm a stock guy, I want to say, or closer to a stock guy than most. And like you said, you nailed it right there. Everything is, you're going to send me a pad that's, let's call stock. It is unreal. So what are we doing here? But with that being said, we don't all need to go back and order retro sets now. Just because I played 10 years ago doesn't mean my pads have to be 10 years old, right? So there was guys, and hey, credit to them, but like one of my, I played with Kerry Ramo with the Toronto Marlies. He was there, and he was rehabbing a knee injury.
I was in Tampa with him.
Yeah, sure. There you go. Right, there you go. So he was a guy who, like, he wore these old school Bauer pads, and he had a ton of straps in the back, and they were cinched up super tight. And if he wasn't careful, he'd land on the face of the pad. He wouldn't land on the knee stack. And I remember like asking him, and credit to him, because man, we both can attest to that. He carved out a pretty good NHL career and whatever. He did it. But I'm like, Kari, what are you doing? Like,
that was like 2016.
Yeah, this was like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. He would wear a pad that looked like it was made for 2002. And I don't even know if I wore 2002, I wore my pads that tight, but they would be cinched on super tight. And he liked it because he liked to move around the crease. He said he wanted to have complete control and command of his pads, and he felt that loose straps didn't give him that. And you try to justify with a guy, well, no, like there's elastics and there's, you know, even if this one's tight, this one can be loose and they're still super responsive and you don't really get much back. So it's interesting how guys are, I don't want to say set in their ways, but guys do it different. And I guess there's tons of different ways to play goal.
My similarity to that was when I was in Jersey and Marty Brodeur was rehabbing an injury and I was up for him and we're in the locker room together. And Marty and I would talk about gear more than anything else, because mine was really modern, and a lot of the guys in the Jersey organization that had grown up in it had really unmodern, old, just whatever they'd get off the shelf, where I was wearing new stuff. I was a geek about it. I came from outside the organization. So Marty was asking me an awful lot, though, about knee stacks, because he didn't even have them yet. He had the old school pads without them, and then I think it was the next year, I look at it, and he's got knee stacks, and I'm like, maybe I could take credit for one thing about Marty Brodeur. Maybe I influenced that in some way. I probably didn't, but it makes me happy to think that maybe somehow I played a small part in his career, you know, like helping usher him into the modern era. But I could talk gear all day long, but I really want to go to your time in Russia, not just because it's Russia, but because you spent the better part, I think, of 7-8 seasons there. First off, how did you end up there? How did you end up leaving Senators organization to go? And then once you got there, you know, what was the experience like just from a goaltending hockey perspective? Equipment, was it hard to get equipment? All those things. There's so many questions about it.
Yeah, it was quite the experience. So starting from the beginning, I didn't receive a qualifying offer that summer from Ottawa. So I became a free agent. And I talked to my agent about possibly going to Europe, but I was 23 years old and not exactly conventional for a goalie, especially at that age, to head over. But I was open to any opportunity at that point. And coming off, like I said, three challenging years in Binghamton, by no means not successful, but just challenging years of learning the position. I got offered two spots actually in Russia and didn't know anything about either one. And at the time, I remember typing both of them into Google and figuring out that, you know, one was here on the map and one was there. And there was like three pitchers from each rink and they both looked the exact same. So I picked Astana, Kazakhstan. And the other option was Chekhov, Vitez. And anybody that's been to Russia knows that Astana now has got a reputation for having tons of imports and being it's outside of Russia. It's a slightly different culture than the culture in Vitez. And nothing wrong with the one in Vitez, but it was a great decision for me to go to Kazakhstan, because I ended up meeting with, I think there were seven of us imports, and you get over there and all of a sudden now it didn't feel so weird. And I'm super thankful for those guys when I got over there, because I didn't speak any Russian. I'd never really been overseas to that point, and now I'm in Kazakhstan. But to what you're asking then, now the hockey part, you show up and you're a little bit overwhelmed with Russia and Kazakhstan, the whole country and the whole atmosphere. And oh, wait, you need gear, right? So the team would always cover your gear. You were just responsible to get it. So a little different than over here, it would be in the summertime, I'd order two or three sets, depending on where I was at in my goalie gear phase. And then I'd bring it all over with me at the beginning of the year. So we laugh, my wife and I, there'd be times we have a big dog. So there'd be a dog, there'd be, you know, four or five hockey bags full of equipment. There'd be one or two suitcases for her, one or two suitcases for me. We'd show up to the airport, you know, looking like a hockey team, and there'd just be two of us traveling. And, you know, the people at the air counter would always look at us, where are you guys? What is going on here? And this was always, you know, a funny thing. And it was the gear that took up all the space.
Tell me about getting your dog into Russia, though, because I explored Europe for a lot of years and I was thinking, man, I can't even get my dog to Russia. How'd you pull it off?
The dog was worse than the gear. It was the hardest thing I've had to do, was get a dog into Russia. And I got a story from every single, I got seven different Russia stories about getting the dog in seven different ways, but it was not easy. And getting it out was even just as hard, if not harder. So, you know, it was a matter of, we have a Bernese Mountain Dog who's 100 pounds, and his kennel looks like two bathtubs stacked on top of each other. So it's not like we're transporting a little Shih Tzu. And so you get to the airport and you got to assemble this crate in front of somebody, and then they take him and he goes to cargo. And next stop for him was Frankfurt, and then he'd hang out there for the night. And they take him out. They have like a dog hotel that apparently they feed him. I like to think that everything went well back there, but I have no idea. But you know, one of my favorite ones was my wife in Frankfurt then would have to go, and you could go, you weren't allowed to see the dog because they were quarantined, but you could go check on him and say, hey, you know, well, all right, yeah, they're good or whatever.
It's alive.
And
this is good.
Yeah, it's alive. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. We still have one. And they said, well, no, the plane that you guys have booked from Frankfurt into Russia, the actual hole in the airplane won't fit your kennel. Like, I don't know what you guys, who booked this for you, but it was the hole, the cargo hold isn't big enough. Well, now what are we going to do? So she calls me in tears because I'm already over there and like, hey, we got to go back to Canada. They're not letting us on the plane. And I don't, at this point, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I get a call a couple hours later and she's like, I'm on the plane. What happened? Well, they in Germany, they allow, I don't know, I hope I don't get somebody in trouble for this, but they allowed her to disassemble the kennel into two pieces. They gave her a vest. They let her walk out on the tarmac with the dog on a leash. They put one part of the kennel up the ramp into the airplane. She walked up the ramp with the dog. They put the dog in the kennel. They assembled the kennel inside the airplane around the dog and took off. Well, good in theory, but now once we get to Russia, the kennel's stuck inside the plane. Like, it has to be disassembled again. So if we were fluent in Russian, or if we had somebody on the ground in Russia, this wouldn't have been so difficult. But now, 6 hours later, she shows up and I'm there. And in Russia, you'd always have a driver who turned out to be your life assistant. So he came in with me. Yeah. And now we had to explain to the counter that my wife has to go back onto the plane, disassemble the kennel into two pieces, and then walk the dog off the actual physical plane. And it was a tough conversation, but hey, he made it. And it was stories like that, and they were never ending in Russia.
That is unbelievable. So the hockey aspect of it, though, you had a great first year, second, you had a great year's period in Russia. And so did you find that your game from North America translated really well to the league over there? Like, were you able to seamlessly enter it like that? And, you know, you'd had those tough years in Binghamton. It must have been a great feeling to go over there and have success right away.
Yeah, it really was. And I think it was just a fresh start, and tons of credit to just all the people I was around over there for A, welcoming me, and B, making the transition so easy, because I was just looking for a new opportunity. And, you know, a guy I really idolized at the time was Ray Emery. So he came over the year prior to me, and he played on a team there at Lant-Matishi, and he was an all-star, and he went over for 1 year, and he was an NHL guy before that, and he was in high, high demand after that. So I said to myself, all right, well, maybe I won't quite get the demand Ray Emery did, but if I go over with the right attitude, I could probably turn this around and flip back. So I signed a 1-year deal with an option. And it wasn't Christmas time before they wanted to extend me. And at that time, as soon as you have success, it's a new environment, perfect, right? Like what more you can speak to this when you're having success in a spot and someone offers you an extension, well, what are we doing here? Like, that's exactly what I was going for.
And let's be honest, it's probably for pretty good money over there too, right?
Exactly. It was multiple times more than what I was making back home. And it was to keep playing on a spot where I was happy, I was having success. So I started looking big picture and saying, well, yeah, like there's no reason for me to rush back if this is going well. And as the story goes, it was literally 7 years of that in a row of just, they were never ever like 2 or 3 year contracts. They were always just a 1-year extension or, you know, whatever. And it kept being a little bit better opportunity, a little different city maybe, or a different country to explore. And it kept being a great option. So when I went over there with the mentality of, oh, I'm just going to flip this around, I ended up really enjoying it, meeting people that, you know, are lifelong friends now, and turning into 7-year career in Russia. Like, I never would have thought that. And so it was only year 7 after having 7 years of success that my agent said to me, he's like, hey, I'm just doubling back on this. If you do want to go try to play in the NHL, you know, you're 30 years old and you can try when you're 35, but it's going to be very hard. You might have a chance at 30 if you want to give it a shot. And that was the only reason why I left that league, is because I only went over there to try to come back, and I ended up enjoying it so much I stuck around so long. But if I didn't leave when I left, I don't think I ever would have had a chance to come back.
That's awesome you got to embrace it. And it's also awesome you got to pad your bank account a little bit, because we all know that that's a huge part of it. It goes into it. But there is something to be said, though, for when you're happy, why change it up? And that's something that even my career people look at. And they think, why have you played in so many places? And I said, it's just the way my career went. It wasn't because I wanted to change. I just never had an opportunity to keep signing or doing long-term contracts with people. And I always had kind of wished, it was like the one regret that I have, that I didn't have some stability like that. It just would have made things a lot easier in a lot of different ways. You know, look at us, like going around to all these cities. And, you know, you went through that for a long time in Russia, and then you come back to North America. And next thing you know, you're kind of back in the blender a little bit, right? Like, you didn't end up with the Rockford IceHogs right off the bat. You took a layover in Toronto. What was the process like in 16, 17 to coming back and deciding you wanted to do that? You know, what was your level of acceptance when it came to what type of option, what type of, you know, contract and opportunity you were going to get, that it felt like it was right for you to do it?
Yeah, you nailed it. And it's so funny. Hearing you say those stories about its stability, that's the one thing that I've often dreamt about, was just a 2 or 3 year contract anywhere, right? Because what you do is you play your whole career on 1 year deals, and a 1 year deal, maybe in the outside, that's a year of stability, but really all a 1 year deal does is set you up for a couple months of preparing for that team, and now all of a sudden you're starting to flip the mentality to next season again, and you know, where am I going to be? Instead of thinking, all right, let's play this year out, you're thinking, if I start well, well, maybe they'll extend me, or maybe I can get a long-term deal somewhere else. So yeah, stability is a kind of a funny conversation. But yeah, going back to your original question, the whole thing coming back was my agent said, you're going to have to check your ego. And that meant contract-wise and opportunity-wise. And, you know, I'd love to be one of these guys that went over there and played in the KHL, and you have 6 or 7 teams offering you one-way contracts to come back. But the reality of it was, is my name had kind of been lost, and there was teams that were willing to give you a tryout. And if you want to come try out and put your name back in the mix, well, then by all means, we'd love to have you, but by no means are we going to offer you a position right off the bat, because we really don't know where you're at.
Yeah.
So I was very, very thankful and lucky for Toronto. And I've said this several times, like they were like, yeah, by all means come to camp. And you know, I think I was cut like 3 or 4 days into camp, which is fine. I totally get that. But it
come
was down
to camp,
to the
we got 60 other goalies and players anyway. They have huge camps for the Marlies every year. Like, they're known for it. And then they get to playoffs and they've got like 3 buses because all the Black Aces too.
Yeah, it was exactly that. And, you know, I got to they started right with the Maple Leafs, and they gave me like number 80, I think. And I was like, oh, this is not good, right? Like, if I'm number 80, like, that's a long ways down the chart. But fine, I went to Marlies. We did a tour, blah, blah, blah. When I got to the Marlies, like you said, they had Garrett Sparks and Anton Bebo, and both were prospects that were at the time, Bebo was actually playing very, very well. And they were both really, really strong goalies. And so I was three behind them. Insert Kari Rommel, maybe I'm four behind them. But I didn't even get a chance to play games. I was just on their practice squad. And, you know, the Maple Leafs would trade for a guy. My job was to practice with them. Guys would stick around after practice, and I would practice with them. So even though I was on the Marlies, technically, I really wasn't, you know. A couple guys got hurt. I think Sparksy got hurt. Biebs got hurt. I got into a couple games. I got two games while I was there, and was super thankful for that chance. And that led into, okay, well, now it's Christmas time, and I've played two games. What are we doing here, right? Because if I want to keep going, I want to play pro hockey, I got to play more than two games. And the opportunity came up in Rockford with no promises, just they were in last place, and they're willing to try some options is really all it was. And if you're willing to come in, we can't offer you anything financially, but it'll be to play a couple games. And I said, well, geez, I mean, like, I'm not even playing here. So I spent a whole half season practicing, and then I got to Rockford and thrown right in the fire. And it was the best thing for me because I got to play games. And the team was just, you know, they were fragile. They'd been losing all year. And I came in, I got to play a couple games. We won some, we lost some, but I think for them, a switch up was good. It was a breath of fresh air. I felt bad for it. It was Matt Carruth and Lars Johansson were the other two goalies with me in Rockford. And you know, they just felt defeated. I could see it on their faces. And so I came in and got to play. And the way it worked with Scott Darling was he was having an outstanding year, and they were expecting to lose him on free agency. And the whole thing was coming up. We had to protect a goalie for the Vegas draft, and And I found a niche, and all of a sudden Chicago offered me a deal. And it was a deal where, yeah, you get to come play in Rockford again next year. But basically the thing was, we need to protect Corey Crawford because we're going to lose Scott Darling.
Yeah. And there were a couple of those deals too. I think Thomas McCollum got one of those.
Right.
And I think maybe Tokarski, but there was like two or three or four guys that got 2-year deals that essentially they were going to be the guy that was exposed in the expansion draft. And they were American League guys that got really good contracts just so teams could protect themselves. So congratulations. That's great.
No, and I totally took advantage of the system. So it was the break I needed. And so they offered me this deal before Christmas time. Before the trade deadline. And all of a sudden I'm on an NHL deal. And okay, well, now this is starting to look more like what I pictured coming back.
And you're playing well too. I mean, this is a good scenario. You could feel building a little bit, right?
Exactly. You're starting to kind of have some confidence, and it's all starting to go in the right direction. And sure enough, Scott Darling breaks his finger, and I got the call. And that was the coolest thing ever was, you know, I went from practicing in Toronto, and not to any fault of anyone in Toronto, just the scenario, what it was, to all of a sudden I'm backing up Corey Crawford, and we're in the United Center, or we were traveling to Joe Louis. We're doing all this stuff. And I'm like, wow, did that happen fast? Right. But it was a matter of sucking it up, I guess, and coming back with the attitude that I don't even know if I was 7th or 8th on the depth chart in Toronto when I got there. But chipping away at it, getting a chance, making the most of your chance, and there you go.
And then you turned into one of the best stories in hockey in the last 5, 6, however many years, because at, what were you, 31?
I think I was your NHL debut,
32?
30, I was going to say 31, 32. Yeah, I was right in there.
I mean, I'm looking back on it, and people ask me about my grind getting there, and I was like, hey, I think I was 25 when I played my first game, and yeah, it was pretty roundabout. I didn't have an entry level and things, but I can't imagine grinding for the better part of 12, 13 seasons before you finally get the chance. What were your emotions like when you finally got the call? And then, I mean, you end up playing 15 games, but tell me about that first game, that first start experience for you.
Yeah, well, I guess it takes 13 years to build a real good story, but it was awesome. So I started the year in Rockford there. I got called up for 7 games, finishing the last story, and never got to play in one, which was fine. I totally understand how that works, and it was cool just to be up with the team. And so the next year, I come back with high expectations, and you know what? JF Berube was in the mix, Anton Forsberg was in the mix, and I'd say I was a healthy 4 in the organization, and even Colin Delia was coming up behind me. So you slot in where you do, and it is what it is. So at Christmas time, Corey Crawford went down, and at the time, nobody knew what it was. I just know that I was at home. I flew back to Calgary for Christmas, and I was enjoying Christmas with my family in every sense of the word, eating and drinking anything that I could see. And I get back on the plane on the 25th at night, to fly back to the Chicago O'Hare Airport and then drive to Rockford. And when I landed, the best the best way to describe it is, you know, that feeling as soon as you get back into service, you're just moments from touching down on the ground and your phone just starts to blow up and you're, all right, I missed something here, right?
Yeah, it's going off like a slot machine. Something weird's happening.
Something's up here. And yeah. I'm thinking,
if you've played
pro hockey
for long enough, you've had this moment at least a couple times.
Right. You just forgot to turn your phone off and the service was on, but you just reconnect with the service and bam. And it's missed call from the GM in Rockford, missed call from the head coach, missed. Okay, so all right, what do I do? So you check your voicemail. You're still on the ground taxiing to the airport. And it's like, hey, call me. So I call him back on the airplane. And it's a small little airplane. And he's like, hey, you got to get to Rockford. You got to get your stuff. And this is like midnight now. I don't want to say I'm hungover. I don't even know if I'm at that stage. I'm just tired.
Was it Bernie that was calling you?
It was Mark Bernard.
Okay,
yeah.
So Mark Bernard's an excitable guy anyway, so I'm sure he was really giving it to you at this point. Like, you gotta call me. You need to call me now. Right?
It was exactly that. It was, how come you haven't returned my calls for the last 4 hours?
Yeah.
And I need you like yesterday to like get to Rockford. So I explained to him where I was and that we had a practice in Rockford at like whatever, 10 o'clock on Boxing Day, and I think we're actually busing somewhere for a game. Fine. So I'm like, well, I can meet you back at the rink like in like an hour. And he's like, make it 45 minutes. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. So it was, so I ripped back to the rink, grabbed my gear. And then it was like an 8 a.m. charter to Vancouver the next morning with the Hawks. So I had to go right back to the airport I came from. I just flew from Calgary to Chicago. And I'm back on the plane like 8 hours later and I'm flying to Vancouver. So whatever, whirlwind of time. We get to Vancouver. Everybody else had some Christmas cheer, I think, too. So we laid an egg in Vancouver. And then the writing was on the wall right then. I was like, oh, I think we lost 5-1 that night. And we flew. We had a back-to-back with Edmonton. So we flew to Edmonton right after the game. And at this point, I'm thinking, yeah, this might be it. And Jimmy Waite came and found me at the elevator. It was like 2 in the morning by the time we got there. Said, hey, you're starting tonight.
And Edmonton's right down the road from Calgary, too.
So that, exactly. So now it's like, all right, it's 2 in the morning. My daughter's like 3-4 months old at this time. So I know if I fired my wife a text message, there'd be a feeding at some crazy hour in the morning where she'd get back to me. So she got back to me real quick. Don't worry about the family and friends. I got all that. We'll all be there. Go play. So I got up, did my morning skate. Did an interview where people were just like happy to see me because I was in my home province. Like, can you believe it? You're in the NHL. Nobody knew I was starting. That the Hawks kept it real hush hush till game time. Came out first. We're up 3-1 in the game. Everything was going great. Gave up too late to make it 3-3. Went to overtime and Patty Kane got one for me in overtime. So, just an unreal feeling. I got a picture here at home where, you know, he's pointing to me down at the other end because it just meant everything to me. I think the guys were all laughing. I was getting ready before the game, and Brent Seabrook asked me, all right, Glasser, when's the last time you played in the NHL? I said, last time. This is the first time.
This is it, and boys.
Nobody really knew the story, so it was pretty cool to get into the game. And then we won the first one in Edmonton just a couple hours from my hometown. And, just an awesome story.
Were you there for rookie party at 32 years of age?
You know what? I missed it. And
I cleared it too, my whole career in the NHL.
I'm fine with not having to cough up for rookie party at 32 years old. So I was okay with that. But yeah, they had that earlier in the year. So I was a rookie, but didn't have to do that.
That's amazing. What a feeling, man. And get to do it in, you know, that close to home and everything. 13 years that it takes to do that. Just so cool that happens. I had the opposite story where we were winning 3-1 going into the third and it went the other direction. I think Malkin had a hat trick on me to bury us 4-3 in overtime, and it was in Pittsburgh. So coming out of that season, though, I mean, out of that experience, so you end up going back to Rockford, go to playoffs. Colin Dealey is hot. You end up coming in. We're playing against each other. Did you think, though, that going to the Calder Cup Finals was within reach for you guys? Because I thought you guys were an incredible team, and it was a hell of a series.
Yeah, you're setting this up way too easy for me. And with all seriousness, going into that series, we knew we had to get to you. You were playing so well then, and credit to you a ton. And I'm not just saying this because you're on the podcast now, but we had a pretty good idea that we matched up a lot better than you guys head to toe, but you were hot. And our whole game plan going into that series is we had to get to the net. We had to somehow get in front of you because if you saw it, you were going to stop it. And you did. And I think we were it turned out, I think we were closer match than what we thought. We thought we were probably the favorite coming in, and I think you guys might have thought that too, but you guys had a lot of good players that played well for you guys in that series.
You know, and our coach was feeding the media that too. I think he called us a beat-up 67 Dusty Mustang or something going into the series. So we were feeding this whole underdog mentality with it.
Yeah, well, but you guys played well, and you especially. And so, it, like you said, you nailed it. Colin Dealey was hot. He came in so hot, and you guys were able to get to him early, and nothing against him. I don't think he lost a game coming into that series. I think he went 7-0 in the first two rounds. It was unreal how good he was playing, and you guys found a way to just one goal here and there, and it happens to all of us. And so getting to play, it was the first time I think we played against each other. I don't know how long, but yeah, it might have been ever.
Like us. It was the first time we'd ever played against each other.
No kidding. And so, so we got to actually play a couple of games, and never forget that double overtime game where you guys got one, and that was it. And so, I mean, it was so much fun to play, and I was happy for you. And after playing in Toronto earlier, and now playing against you guys in the conference finals, it was exciting to watch the AHL finals that year and see what was going to happen.
Yeah, we gave it our best. That team was an absolute wagon, though, man. I'm looking at this, though, and how throughout your career, I mean, you really didn't play a lot of playoff hockey, though. You know,
nope.
And in Rockford, you played those couple games, but it wasn't until this year that you really got to carry the mail in playoffs. And I know you got a taste of it the year before with Rockford, but for you, what was the feeling like with everything on the line like it is in playoffs, getting a chance to play, carry a team, and go deep into playoffs like you did with San Diego this year?
Yeah, you nailed it. I remember the press release came out. It was my first AHL playoff game. I was like 32 years old, and I played with the Hawks that year. And is this really my first? And I thought back, yeah, no, we were terrible in Binghamton. We weren't even close to the playoffs. And so I played a few playoff series in Russia, which is a different story just because of the matchups there. So tough in the first round. If you're not a wagon, you're the other team. And we were the other team over there. So tough matchups in Russia. But this was the first time where I was like, wow, two evenly matched teams. Here's a chance to play some games and play for keeps. And I love playoff hockey. It was so much fun to play. And I wish they would all be like that. We all do. But so that was a great little experience for me last year. And then this year, it's a very similar situation, eerily similar, how Kevin Boyle caught fire this year. And it's fun watching these guys catch fire because they, like, can't miss. And I think he won 12 in a row. And credit to him, because it was like there was nights where he wouldn't get a lot of shots and he'd come up with the one big save. And then there'd be nights where he'd have like 40, 50 shots and he would be unreal as well. And he did it every different way. And he was hot. But going into the playoffs, we realized it's a best of five in the first round, and things happen fast. And our coach told both of us that, hey, if something happens, we're going to make a change. And it's no offense to either one of you. And three went in the first 5 minutes of game one, and I got into that one. And then I got to play all of round one, all of round two, and start round three. And it was a great experience for me because I got to all of a sudden show not what I could do, but actually how much fun playoff hockey is. And I think we all play for playoff hockey, but until you actually get to go a couple rounds and enjoy it and feel your body break down and all those things that come along with playoff hockey, it's hard to describe. And so it was a lot of fun this year. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I think the best part of it that a lot of people don't get to understand until they talk to somebody like us that's been far, conference final or all the way to the finals, is that, you know, really the first round, you're kind of like, yeah, we're in playoffs. And then you get to the second round and it gets a little bit more serious, but there's still that, well, you know, another monthly rent. And you get past the second round, though, man, and all of a sudden it's like a light switch flips that guys are all in. And it's like, well, we're this far, we might as well win the whole thing. Like, I have a hard time describing that to people, how, at least from my experience, that's how it's been for some of the teams I've been on. Have you felt that too?
100%. And that was exactly, you nailed it with the American League mentality of the first couple rounds, everyone's involved. I don't ever want to say that guys aren't invested. That's not the attitude.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
As soon as it flips to round three, it's like, hold on a second here. We're only like, we're here this long anyways. Like, what's a couple more weeks? Let's win this thing. And you don't have to look back. Guys step up in the dressing room, and you see guys that have won Calder Cups and what it's done for their careers individually and as a team and what it means. And guys realize real fast, oh, okay, we're on the brink of something real special here. And you nailed it. The intensity ramps up in that third round, and super fun to be a part of. And that's now where all of a sudden boys become men, and you start to see who you're, what you're really about. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, there's no feeling like it. And what's next for you? Because I know you've got some things going back home in Calgary, though, that you've become a bit of an entrepreneur as well, aside from your hockey career. So, you know, where do you see yourself even 4 or 5 years out from now, not just particularly in the next 6 months?
I've been one of those guys. July 1, for some reason, I get no reception in my house here. The phone never seems to be ringing that hard on July 1. It's always a little later into July when maybe the phone starts to heat up. But I still feel like I got some hockey left in me. So we'll see here. I'm going to keep going at it and see where it takes me. I'm hoping I can slot in somewhere here in the hockey world, let's say, for the next year or two. But touching on your point, we were lucky enough to open a fitness studio here in Calgary 5 years ago. It's called the Sweat Lab, and I give myself a quick plug. But it was it's a spin yoga bar studio that another former hockey player, Matt Kinch, and myself decided to do with our wives. And it was kind of a side project for me while I was over in Russia. It was something for my wife to do. When you go over there, there's not a lot she can do. She's not allowed to work in Russia. But we set the company up in a way where a lot of stuff can be done online from her point of view. So it gave her something to do over there and gave me something to kind of explore and dabble in. And I wasn't sure if it was something I wanted to get into or just something to try. And so we actually ended up opening a second location last summer in North Vancouver. Now we got two locations going. And like you said, it's starting to be more than just something on the side. I really enjoy it. And taking on the whole side of something to do after hockey, it might be something that I want to get into. But at this point, I'm not quite ready yet to do the Roberto Luongo and send out the picture of my pads hanging on a on a phone line. But I'm definitely enjoying the last couple of years of my career here, and we'll see where it takes me.
Awesome stuff. We have so much in common. So just getting the chance to talk to you is really cool, because I'm sure we could go on forever. But Jeff, thanks a bunch. Best of luck in the future, and I'm sure everybody's going to enjoy it. So thanks again.
No, I really appreciate you having me on, and best luck to you in this. This is pretty cool. I got a lot of time for any other goalies out there, and I really enjoy what you're doing here. Have fun with it.
Thanks, man. Just a couple of relics.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.